Most crime, including murder and sexual assault, is done by men. Are men toxic? Are they inherently violent and inferior to women? These are some of the questions we're going to try to answer in this edition of The Commonwealth Matters. I am Richard Nelson, your host. Joining us to talk further is Professor Nancy Piercy, author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. Professor Piercy is a professor and a scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. She's been highlighted as one of the five top women apologists by Christianity Today and hailed in The Economist as America's preeminent evangelical Protestant female intellectual. Nancy, welcome to The Commonwealth Matters.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I have your book here in hand, The Toxic War on Masculinity, and I read a lot of books. This is part of my job. I'm not always sure what I'm getting into, but I do need to say that you have quite a book here. Didn't know what to expect. Very impressed by it. And I'd like to cover some of the main points, some of the high points in your book that really it would take several programs, and we don't have time to do that. But I'm going to start out with this idea that there is a toxic war on masculinity. You say early on in your book that according to one media researcher, in his analysis of 2,000 mass media portrayals of men, he found that 75% of men were portrayed as villains, aggressors, perverts, and philanderers. This didn't happen in a vacuum, did it? So here's the question. How did we get to this place where men today are vilified in popular culture as being toxic?
Well, yeah, exactly. What caught my attention was how hostile the media has become to men. For example, one of the ones that really caught my eye was an article in the Washington Post titled, "Why Can't We Hate Men?" Really? In a mainstream publication? Or the Huffington Post had an editor who tweeted out hashtag kill all men and then said it was a joke. And speaking of jokes, you can buy t-shirts that say so many men, so little ammunition. And there are books with titles that are very blunt, like I Hate Men and No Good Men and Are Men Necessary? So what really was tragic, though, is when I saw even men attacking their own sex. A fairly well-known book author actually wrote, talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer. And then this one you may have seen because it was more recent, so it's not even in the book, but it was in the news where the producer of the movie Avatar, James Cameron, said testosterone is a toxin that you have to work out of your system. So no wonder men feel as if the culture is hostile to them today. I do quote a psychotherapist who writes for the Wall Street Journal. And she said, especially younger men are coming in feeling depressed, demoralized, and beaten down because they feel like they feel emasculated, is how she put it, because they're growing up in a culture that's hostile to masculinity. A 2020 survey here in America found that almost half of American men agree with the statement, these days society seems to punish men just for acting like men. So whether you agree with that or not, that's a lot of people who think that men are getting a bad deal today. And so that's why I think we need to pay attention to it. I think it's about time that we had some compassion on men and the negative social pressure that they're under today. And even in the church, I teach at a Christian university, Houston Christian. And when I told my class that I was writing a book on masculinity, one of my male students shot back, "What masculinity? It's been beaten out of us." So I thought, okay, that's why I have to write this book. You know, I want to find a way to help men, to affirm and support men.
I think we need to start at this basic idea. From a biblical view, there is a difference between male and female. We're both equally made in the image of God. Both male and female have equal dignity, equal value, equal worth. But there are clear biological differences between male and female, physiological differences as well. And I mean, men are, they do have more testosterone. They do have greater upper body strength. They are wired, if you will, differently, generally differently than women. Do you think that there's something else going on here where we live in an age of expressive individualism, where people are told that they can determine their own sex, their own gender? Do you think that there's something related to that that would say that because you're male, that you're built biologically and physiologically different, trying to do away with that? Is this at play here as well?
Well, yeah, that's covering a lot of ground. On the one hand, I did find that I had to put this right at the beginning of my book, because people would say, well, what do you think is the difference between men and women then? And I would have to say, well, let's just start with the biology. It's clear, like you said, men are bigger, stronger, faster. They have more fast twitch muscles, which means they can react more quickly. Because of testosterone, they are more aggressive in general, more risk-taking. And we do have to affirm that as the baseline of, you know, the created givens. This is how God made men. And we have to at least start with, we have to acknowledge that what God creates is good. And therefore, we have to acknowledge that these differences are good. I think some of the reason for feminism is that many people fear that if you acknowledge differences, somebody's going to be less than. And let's face it, that does happen. It's just normal. It's human that when we make a distinction, we often think one is better and one's worse. And so historically, it has in fact been true that feminine characteristics have been denigrated as, you know, weak and inferior. And so at the same time we affirm men, we do have to make sure we're standing against feminism by saying, hey, we can acknowledge what's good about women too. And again, start with the basic biology. Women's superpower is that they can have children. And that spills over into their psychology as well, because to take care of an infant requires a certain quality of character. You have to be willing to be interrupted no matter what you're doing, right? Because when an infant is in distress, you don't, you know, shove them aside and say, wait, I'm not done yet. You don't reason with them. You don't punish them. You meet their distress immediately. And you have to be very sensitive to nonverbal cues because they're not talking yet. And you have to be very sensitive to threats in the environment. So women become mama bears. And so I think we have to be very careful that we acknowledge the differences, but we don't ever let it become a better, worse situation, that we're always affirming what's good about God's created order and God's design for men and women.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Have you ever wondered why America is the most prosperous nation in history? We've certainly been blessed, but we take the conditions for prosperity for granted. That's why CPC is hosting the Toward a Better Bluegrass Conference. We've invited some of the top thinkers and leaders to speak about the sources of our economic strength. Biblical principles, America's founding framework, and individual capacity are a few issues that we'll be addressing. So please join us on October the 18th in Lexington. And for more information, go to our website, commonwealthpolicycenter.org, and we look forward to seeing you there.
Nancy, Christianity in particular is being attacked today by those who say it is misogynistic, patriarchal, that it hurts women, demeans women. In some cases, I guess you could find examples that would support that. But the biblical view, the biblical record does not say that, does not teach that. In fact, you make the case in your book that the Christian view of gender and marriage is a good for both men and women. You go on to say that, for example, devout Christian men have the lowest rates of divorce and the lowest rates of domestic violence of any other group that is surveyed out there. 73% of wives who hold conservative gender roles and attend church regularly are happier in their marriage and have higher quality marriages. And yet Christianity is being attacked as being part of the problem. How do you respond to that?
Well, yes, this is, you know, in the media narrative, certainly Christian men, especially theologically conservative Christian men, are exhibit A of toxic masculinity. I'll give you just one example. I have lots of them in my book. They were easy to find. But the co-founder of the Church Too movement, which followed the Me Too movement, the co-founder said, "The theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today." Well, that's an empirical claim. You know, is it true that holding to some sort of headship or authority in the home turns men into these overbearing, tyrannical patriarchs? Well, so the social scientists were listening to these charges and saying, where's your evidence? You know, you're making these accusations, but where's your data? And so they went out and did the studies. I quote about a dozen studies in my book by psychologists and sociologists. And to my own surprise, you know, I didn't expect this myself. But yes, you were right. Evangelical Christian men test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers. And the first question I always get is, well, what do their wives say? You know, if the wife is sitting right next to her husband, of course she said that. No, they do interview the wives separately. So what they're saying is that the wives report the highest level of happiness in their marriage. Evangelical fathers spend more time with their children than secular men, 3.5 hours more per week. They have the lowest rate of divorce, 35% lower than secular couples. And then, as you said, the most surprising thing is they actually have the lowest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any group in America. And so the quote that you gave, the 73%, that's from Brad Wilcox. He's a sociologist at the University of Virginia. He did the largest study. And to give you a sense of his stature, he writes in places like the New York Times. And so that number that you quoted is actually from a New York Times article in which he said, it turns out that 73% of women who hold conservative gender values and attend church regularly with their husbands have high quality marriages. And by the way, he then turns to his secular colleagues, because sociology does tend to be a more secularized field. And he says, academics need to cast aside their prejudices against religious conservatives and evangelicals in particular, because Protestant evangelical men test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers. So this is not a pep talk from some religious leader, right? This is solid empirical research. This is evidence-based findings that we should be very confident about, well, first bringing into our churches, because it's not there yet. I had to go digging in the academic literature to find this, so we need to bring it into our churches. And we should also be confident bringing it into the public square to counter the negative secular narrative that's in the media today.
Very good. Nancy, your book really digs deep into history. You go back church history, you look at American history. And one of the things you point to, a period of history that has hurt the home and hurt marriages and strong families, is the time of industrialization. And that happened in this country between 1750 to 1850. And you say that it took a toll on manhood as it wrested men from their homes where he and his wife worked side by side. And then also you go on to say that the market economy that we're in today and that we've been in since colonial days, that affects how men relate to their families. So industrialization, I mean, that's something nobody was going to stop that unless you become Amish or Mennonite. Where do men go? I mean, is your solution for men to go, and I know this is a lot here, but how do we as Christian men who care about strong families and care about healthy marriages, how do we, taking what you shared in your book, that industrialization and taking man out of the home and this, a man and woman, a husband and wife working side by side, is that something you're saying that we should go back to in order to have stronger families and stronger marriages?
I got into it because I wanted to explain where the negative view of masculinity came from, because most people think 1960s, second wave feminism, and I found I had to go much further back. Like you say, the Industrial Revolution was a huge change, because before that, men and women worked side by side on the family farm, the family industry, the family business. And so there was an interrelationship between husband and wife, and interdependence that was lost with the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution took work out of the home. And as a result, men had to follow their work out of the home into factories and offices. And for the first time in American history, men were not working alongside their family members, right? People they loved and had a moral bond with. Instead, they were working as individuals in competition with other men. And that's a very different work environment. And this is when you see the literature change, not in the 1960s, you know, more like the 1860s. You start to see the literature change in terms of people saying that men were losing the caretaking ethos that they'd had in an earlier age, that you, even secular historians say that in the colonial era, the ideal for manhood was duty to God and man. You know, so very duty and service driven. Well, people began to complain that men working as individuals in the industrialized workplace tend to be focused much more on their individual achievement, individual accomplishment, career success. I was surprised when I read the literature of the day how often they complained that men were turning their career into an idol. That was the word frequently used. And so that is when, you know, if you want to know when the literature changed and when did men start being described negatively, you have to go all the way back to there. And that does, of course, give a sense of what a solution might be. Is there a way that we can, even in an industrial world, you know, tweak the edges to allow men to have more time with their family? And I give lots of stories. Right now, it's at the anecdotal level, right? So I went out and interviewed a lot of people who'd found ways to work, you know, either from home or at least part-time from home. And the pandemic was a game changer. This is not in the book because it's more recent, but Harvard University did a study and they said 65% of fathers said that during the pandemic, they got closer to their children and they don't want to lose that. And so fathers want to be involved with their kids. 70 in another survey, 70% of fathers said they would prefer more time with their children, even if it meant a reduced salary. And ironically, in a totally different study, the same number, 70% of wives said they would prefer their husbands to have more time at home, even if it meant a lower salary. So millennials consistently say in surveys they really want a better balance. Women do want a chance to work in the workplace, you know, and use the skills that they've developed, especially if they've gone through higher education. But they want to be home too, because they want to be with the kids. Fathers want a better balance too. What we don't have yet is the structures that really make that possible. But I did, in my book, I looked at CEOs who acknowledged again that during the pandemic, their ideas changed. I quote one CEO who said, before the pandemic, we were very suspicious of any sort of remote work, right? They just thought people would slough off. He said, this is a direct quote, the pandemic completely exploded those fears. We did not see any drop in productivity. So I think we're at a point now where we can make a better case. And I'm not saying everybody should, you know, try to work more from home. I'm interested in children. I'm interested in children. So I'm talking about parents in particular, having a more flexible work style when they're raising young children.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, Richard Nelson here. There's got to be a better way to engage politics. That's why I wrote a new book focusing on how Christians can lead the way. It's called Christianity and Politics, a memoir of spiritual formation and field guide for Christians in the public arena. This is a refreshing perspective on how believers can engage the political realm, and it's available for pre-order on Amazon today. So please check it out. I think you're going to find it helpful.
If you're just joining us, you're tuned into the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Professor Nancy Piercy, and we're talking about her new book, The Toxic War on Masculinity. And I said new book, it came out last year. Fascinating book, though. Nancy, you talked about another important development in our history as to affecting the idea of masculinity, and it's the scientific revolution. And you said that that eventually led to thinking that said that the only reliable form of knowledge is what can be known by science, empirically verifiable facts, whereas moral and spiritual truths don't qualify since they cannot be tested. And morals and spiritual truths were reduced to personal preferences and redefined as private feelings. Therefore, morality was relegated to the sphere of family, church, and personal relationships and did not have a role in the public sphere. So were you saying that this somehow hurt the idea of masculinity?
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, moral and spiritual truths can be tested, just not empirically. Just want to throw that in there because I think they can be tested. But yes, here's how it affected masculinity. At the same time that the industrial revolution was taking men out of the home, the scientific revolution was persuading many people that empirical knowledge was the only form of knowledge and that therefore moral values don't belong in the public realm, right? this was also part of the Industrial Revolution. We began to have very large public institutions like the state, industry, business, financial institutions, banks, universities, and so on. And many people began to argue that these large public institutions should operate by quote unquote scientific principles. And, you know, we shouldn't worry about morality. And that's why morality then gets pushed over into the private sphere. Well, what does that mean? That means that men are the ones at that time getting that secularized education, working in that secularized work environment. And so men did, historically, they became secular in their outlook earlier than women did. So it had a huge impact on their character because, of course, then they were less committed to a Christian view of morality, to a Christian view of what manhood is, what God's design is for men. And in fact, what took its place, by the way, I go through several stages of the secularization of the masculine script, but my favorite stage was the rise of Darwinian evolution. And most people are surprised because they think, wait, that's about science. It had an enormous impact on men because by then, if science was the truth, well, what was science saying? Social Darwinists were saying that the men who won out on top in the struggle for survival would be brutal, savage, barbarian, and predatory. And so instead of urging men to live up to the image of God in them, they urged men to live down to what they called the beast within.
Nancy, I'm glad that you brought up Darwinianism because Darwin also had a very low view of women. He believed that they were subservient to men, less capable, less in many categories. And I'm fascinated that so many scientists who would consider themselves enlightened can, I guess, maybe parse out. They believe in Darwinian evolution, and then they want to somehow get rid of his low view of women. But I would say that's just part of the whole package. this is survival of the fittest, right? They're those who are strongest, those who are the fittest, they're going to make it. And look, physically, that is the way it works in the animal kingdom, but we're not merely animals, are we?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, yes, Darwin himself specifically argued that women were intellectually inferior in every way. And by the way, he acknowledged that they are emotionally more sympathetic and more caring and more compassionate. But then he said, but those are the traits of the lower animals. So even in the area where he said women were, you know, were superior, they were actually, that was a sign of their lower, they were on a lower rung of the evolutionary ladder. So yeah, it's important, I think, especially in our day where science is still held up to a large extent as the ultimate truth. By the way, Darwin was also a racist. He did believe that the other races were less evolved. I mean, if you accept evolution, it's not unusual to think, well, maybe, you know, different cultures are different, ethnic groups are at different stages of evolution. That was a logical conclusion, and he did conclude that. So people defending Darwin will say, well, he was against slavery. That's true, but not because he thought other races were equal. He still thought that they were on a lower rung of the evolutionary ladder. And you're right. By the way, Darwin's statue has been removed. I think it's from the British Museum of Natural History, because finally people are starting to say, well, Darwin had some things wrong. It was the racism. It was because of the racism that they removed his statue. So that might be a good sign that people are starting to see that Darwinism has some problems with it, not to mention some of the scientific problems.
Very good. Nancy, we're going to wrap this up, but I want to, as we've talked about, there are several consequences of demeaning true manhood, but one of the consequences of belittling manhood, you say in your book, is that the danger and consequence of emasculating men is that women will be left with boys who have no incentive to mature or honor their commitments. How do we change course? And we might need to do an entirely separate program on this, but how do we change course? Manhood has a very negative view. Men have been beaten down. Men are suffering today. I think we've lost a solid theological moorings when it comes to manhood. But how do we change course? Is there a particular place we need to begin?
Well, that's kind of the big question, right? About what is a biblical view of manhood and how do we have a more positive understanding of the biblical view. A lot of boys are just dropping out, right? They're dropping out of dating. They're not even trying to form relationships anymore. They're spending their time, you know, the classic image of the 23-year-old who's in his mother's basement playing video games is a little bit too true. I thought maybe I would tell you how a liberal person changed, because sometimes it's fun to see how a Christian view becomes so compelling that it even persuades a liberal. There's a liberal woman who she's a journalist, and she's British. So she used to write for the New Statesman, which is a very left-leaning publication. And she's come out with a book called The Case Against the Sexual Revolution. And what happened is she began to work at a rape crisis center. And that finally persuaded her that as a culture, we have to acknowledge the differences between men and women. For the woman's sake, that's why it can sell, right? If you frame it for the women's, but nonetheless, it is true. Her point was, if you're at a party and you're with a guy and you're both half drunk, you need to get out of there because you're at risk. He's bigger, he's stronger, and you're the one who's at risk. She worked at a rape crisis center. And so that was the beginning of her change. She started to acknowledge the differences between men and women. And from there, she went to, well, men's traits are intrinsically good, and marriage is intrinsically good, and morality is actually pretty good. I saw her recently in a podcast where a secular interviewer was like asking her, well, what should you do, in terms of dating and sex? That question was, when do you have sex? And she said, well, not until you're married. And he was like, what? You've got to be joking. And she held up her hand like this with her wedding ring on it. And she said, you don't want to have sex with a man until you're pretty sure he's going to stick around and help take care of any children that result. And this ring is a pretty good guarantee. So read the book if you want to, for a fun example of a very liberal person who's come to a conservative and perhaps even a Christian perspective.
That's good. That's a good note to close on. Professor Nancy Piercy, her book is called The Toxic War on Masculinity. Nancy, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you all for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters. Until next time, may God bless you.